Welcome to the Pussy Parlor Podcast. I am your host, Kitty Velour. I am a pole dance artist, glittery showgirl, and a pole dance and floor work instructor. Here at the parlor, I interview new guests each week, including pole dancers, strippers, showgirls, sex workers, and cabaret creatures of all kinds. Our parlor guest today is TT Bang, a drag queen, DJ, and performer from London. TT is a queer icon, having featured in Channel 4's Drag SOS as one of the first self-proclaimed female drag queens. TT is known for her colourful, feminine, bubbly drag looks and is an advocate for queer issues and rights. In this episode, we talk about people's reactions to TT being a female drag queen, club kid culture and nightlife, and London's queer venues. Welcome to the Pussy Parlor, TT Bang.
I'm excited.
Me too. You know what? I've always seen you in and around London when I was living in London, which is actually quite a long time ago now, 4 years. But I've never really sat down to have a chat with you about the world of you.
Been in a nightclub or been in a nightclub. There's never.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just excited to learn a little bit more about your journey. Could you introduce yourself for our listeners?
So I'm TT Bang. I am a drag queen, artist, gender bender, queer woman, artist. I do anything you pay me to do, basically.
Love that. And how did you get into drag? How did that all start?
Oh my goodness, it feels like a million years ago now. And really, honestly, I don't know where the start is. Do you know what I mean? I feel like I was really, when I moved to London, so I was 18 when I moved to London, and I came down from a small town in the Lake District, and I was really just looking for somewhere to belong and a community, I guess. I felt like I hadn't really had a community that I belonged to. And I basically just wanted to go out and dress up. That's what I was like into. I was into cabaret. I wanted to like see it all, be around it, be immersed in it. And I just used to go out and dress up, and you just meet people, and they gave me opportunities. I used to go to, in the olden days, Madame Jojo's used to be open in Soho. And I used to basically volunteer there to show people to their seats so that I could just watch cabaret for free. Because obviously when you first move to London, you have no money. So anything you can do, like a free night out. And I remember I used to show people to their seats for a competition called Burlesque Idol that used to happen. And 1 week someone dropped out and they were like, oh, we've got a spot. Do you want to perform? I just said, yes. And I performed and I got to the final with the likes of Ruby Jones and Aurora Galore. And then it kind of just went from there. I realized quite quickly that maybe I was like a bit too queer for like the burlesque scene. And so I started to hang around with drag queens more, mainly just like being in queer spaces more. And before I knew it, everyone was like, oh, you're a drag queen. And so I was like, okay, well, that's what you want to call it.
Yeah, it sounds like it's kind of an organic thing that happened gradually.
Yeah, I didn't ever go out being like, I want to be a drag queen. I think it was very different like 10 years ago. There wasn't the culture around drag that there is now. So in those days, people didn't really aspire to be professional drag queens. We were just queer people that like dressing out and going out and like getting, if you go out in London as well, when you're dressed up, when you're young, you're getting everywhere for free. And you know this, you get free drinks or you get to go clubbing. Like I used to go out like four nights a week just for free, just to dress up and be myself.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. I think that's the fun thing about living in London. It's you can get away with that. You can just dress up completely wacky and it's going to play to your favor.
Yeah, it really does. Because people want to know who you are and that gives you opportunities. But I guess professionally drag, I guess I realized I was a drag queen when I started making more money doing drag than I did in my day job. And then you're like, oh yeah, this is like a job now, isn't it?
People were paying me money.
Yeah, people actually pay me money. I'm not just spending everything I have on doing drag. But it was very organic and it was just me being me and exploring myself. And I just happened to build a bit of a following because of it. And I mean, yeah, I'm very grateful for the experience.
And what was your drag like when you did this burlesque idol performance? Like, what were you wearing?
Oh my God, it was so basic. It was like the most like what I thought burlesque was meant to be. I was wearing like a corset and there was pearls and there was no wig. I don't even know if there was a lash. Like, there barely was a lash. But but it evolved, and I think I was really fortunate people gave me stages to perform on. And I think it was probably a bit easier because it wasn't as saturated back in the day. And I used to perform at like the Royal Vauxhall Tavern a lot. And you weren't getting paid for it. You were doing it because you wanted to do it. And yeah, I just started exploring different stories and different parts of myself. And then things started building up. Before you know it, you're wearing like 5 wigs and 5 corsets and it's drag.
And what kind of inspired your outfits at the beginning? Was it like other people that you were around, or did you just want to kind of do something that maybe you couldn't do when you were living in the Lake District?
I think it was probably just me amplifying different parts of myself. I hadn't had the opportunity or the safe environment to amplify those things in. Being in queer spaces in London, there really was no rules. And at first, I guess I was really inspired by musical theatre. I love old musicals and big costumes and drama. And I've always been attracted to things that are camp and silly and girly. And I love femininity. I think femininity is just like the most powerful aspect of humanity. And I just wanted to explore it. So it was always camp and it was always colourful and girly, but I think it's just got bigger and bigger over the years.
Yeah, I remember, I think when I first came across you on Instagram and you were just so like pink and glittery and I was like, I love this person. Who are they? I need to meet them.
Yeah, I do love pink. I feel like I'm wearing less pink now. I'm getting like, I'm moving on a little bit. Things are changing. But yeah, I think for such a long time when I was a teenager, I was like an emo. I was into like punk and things that are a bit darker. And then I got into the scene kid movement where it was all like bright colors and it was like slightly 80s. And then when I sort of developed my skills in like costume making, like I taught myself to sew from quite a young age, and being around other queer people, I learned other skills as well to be able to build costumes. And so the abilities I had to create looks got better, so my imagination also expanded with that, which I think made my style develop into what it is. I don't know what it is. It is quite something.
It's fabulous. I love it. So many things that we could talk about in terms of career highlights for you, because I feel like I've just seen so many things that you've done, a documentary, been on TV, you've done, you're like featured in a book. So what for you would you consider like key moments in your career?
I have a few moments where I was sort of self-reflecting in the moment and I was like, wow, you've done it. I think the first was because I used to perform, but I also then accidentally got into DJing at the Black Cap in Camden, because there wasn't really people doing it. And I remember being out at a club and being like, this music's like kind of average, but I reckon I could like pick a better selection. So I started DJing there. And then I basically got booked for like a corporate gig with YouTube, and it was at like the Roundhouse. And I was so nervous. I don't think I even slept for like 2 days beforehand. Because until that point, I felt like I was faking it. I was like, I'm just pretending to be this drag queen DJ. And then I got this really big corporate gig and I was like, oh no, they really think I am. Like, they think that I am this person. But I remember having a moment when I was like on the stage during the night where I was like, wow, you're doing it. Like, you're, and I don't know if that's just like my own like lack of belief in myself maybe, but I had a moment then when I was on this huge stage at the Roundhouse being like, wow, you're really, you know what you're doing, you're not faking it anymore. So that like is so nothing to anyone else, but for me that was like a moment. And then I guess obviously when Drag SOS came out on Channel 4, that was like a big moment because I was the first sort of self-proclaimed female drag queen to appear on TV. And there hadn't really been anyone like me on mainstream TV before. And so obviously when I was having that experience, it was very surreal and I'm incredibly proud of it. You know, I know it's not Drag Race and it's not a huge phenomenon, but for me, that opportunity was like somebody saying, like, your drag is valid and you deserve as much of a place at the table as everybody else. And so that was really amazing. And then again, like the Glitterbox documentary, I'm really, really proud of that, because that is like, it's like a little archive of nightlife that I get to look back at and be like, wow. Like, I'm sure I'll look back at in like 50 years and be like, look at that. That is what nightlife was. And I was a part of that. And I mean, I've been so fortunate. I've had so many good opportunities come my way. I don't know. I sometimes say it's down to luck, but I don't know what it is. I also like work my ass off, so maybe it's that.
Yeah, I think it's quite common for creatives to get sort of imposter syndrome. I think it's quite a common thing. And you're always juggling a lot of different plates as well. So I think that kind of plays into it. But no, I just think that you have something really unique and special. And I think now I'm looking back, I don't know if you probably were the first like female drag queen that I knew about. And I think a lot of people who maybe aren't familiar with like the queer scene or with drag and performance maybe don't know that you can be a drag queen of like any gender. It doesn't have to be a specific thing. Have you come across that when you've been performing or working? Have people ever been surprised?
Oh, all the time. All the time.
Really?
Even like with the age of the internet and with the age of like people understanding that gender is way more complex than male or female, like people still, there is like quite a specific demographic of people, I think, that say it now. There tends to be a lot of older people that don't really get it, because obviously the media has told us for years and years and years that drag is men dressing up as women, and all the references we have are of men dressing up as women. And for me, I think it's because the people creating those references, those movies like Priscilla Queen of the Desert or Drag Race or whatever they are, the people creating shows and content about drag and about drag queens are also cisgendered men. And so they don't even think, oh, like it's bigger than me. Because drag is bigger than just cisgendered men. I mean, the history around trans people performing in drag and also cis women performing in drag, we are there in history. It's just that our stories have not been given those same platforms. And so, you know, I do think that as we start to understand on a bigger sort of cultural context that things have been dictated by the patriarchy for so long and everything has been made predominantly by cis white men, that maybe also drag will come into it and we'll realize, oh yeah, like the drag we've been presented has only been from one side of the story. And so it is changing, but yeah, I get it all the time. I kind of like don't mind either. I'm just like, you know what, I would rather me have to explain what it is than somebody maybe who is going to take it more personally than me and be more offended and hurt by it. I would rather be the one that, you know, has the conversation with you and explains what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Why do you think that Drag Race is so like more, I don't know, like old fashioned in the way that it presents drag? Because we know that in the cabaret and performance communities that drag is made up of a lot of different things. It's not just drag queens, there's drag kings and there's non-binary and there's loads of different aspects to it. And I feel like it's only showing one side of it. And I don't understand why they haven't changed, you know?
Yeah, I think it's obviously the most palatable version of drag. It's the part of drag that the mainstream is going to understand. And it is a mainstream show. You know, it's not actually made for queer people anymore. It's made for the mass and like the bigger audience. And so TV and people in TV are really scared to take risks. You know, like I saw it myself when we were doing our shows. They're scared to put their head on the line and put their money where their mouth is, because there is so much involved in it and there is so much money involved in Drag Race that if they mess up, then, you know, it's to the detriment of the entire brand. But I do think it is changing, but it is probably changing because the queer community has been pushing back and saying, actually, hello, like we're here as well. And hopefully, yeah, in the next few years it will be more expansive, but I feel like I have been shouting into a void for the past 10 years about it.
Yeah, I know if anyone listening, if they haven't watched it, Dragula with the Boulay brothers, yeah. I know that they've had like drag kings and like could just, yeah, more wider variety of genders included. So that's always something good to watch as well.
And the sort of aspect of like competition in drag is something that like now when people that have been brought up on Drag Race go to drag shows, they think it's like a competition and that the drag queens are competing against each other to be the best, when actually like the community itself is based on like nurturing each other and supporting each other, because we are all outcasts and have been judged our entire lives. So like, I would love to see more shows where we're not pitting queer people against each other in general, that it's just more of like a celebration.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think something that Licorice said in their interview about, they feel like they have to be in like a drag race look every time they go out. And it used to be a lot more kind of casual and you could just kind of be a bit more experimental with it, but now people expect drag to be a certain way and it has to be like really polished and everything like that. But you know, it's not like that. It's completely different, and it's a lot more kind of like wacky and a little bit more messy at times, and it's still great and valid.
On like a Tuesday night, we were not wearing like full gowns and crystals. We were just wearing like something we got from the market, and like you didn't care if you spilt your drink on it. And now it's like you have to be in like full rhinestones, otherwise you're not doing drag, and it's just so silly.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you want to see the real drag, you need to like go out and go and see shows and be immersed in that. You know, it's not just what you see on TV.
Yeah, yeah, it's really not. And I think also like it's reality TV and we forget that. Like it's completely contrived, whether you like it or not. Like it's completely produced to tell a story and to make you feel certain emotions. And you can forget that those people are just like normal queer people trying to survive. Yeah, so we need to remember that it's not real life. Like drag, like all reality, all anything on television is not real life.
You're such an advocate for queer rights. I love all the posts that you share. I did like a series about like historical queer people, which I really enjoyed. What do you think are some of the most important things that anyone listening to this needs to know about, and how can we kind of also be allies?
I think it's about listening and allowing yourself to be wrong sometimes. I think as an ally, sometimes people are like, oh, I'm an ally. And then if they get challenged in that allyship, they get really defensive. And it's really good to listen. And especially now, I think it's really important to be listening to our trans brothers and sisters and siblings, and also having more conversations around pronouns. I think are like minor things that we can be doing to try and sort of better the environment that we live in for queer people. But we do also need to remember the bigger picture. And there are a lot of people that are really, really struggling right now with themselves and especially with isolation. And so we just have to listen to those stories and be able to actually hear what these people are saying and learn from it. Like be willing to learn and recognize that you don't know everything and that you're not going to be the perfect ally all the time. And I think that goes for things around race as well. Especially we need to be listening to like our queer siblings of color right now more than ever, and actually taking on board what they're saying and not being defensive about it. I mean, even myself, I'm constantly learning things that I don't know. And that's why I really enjoyed doing the queer history series, like, because people were like, oh, it's amazing, I didn't know about any of these people. But also so many of them I didn't know about. I didn't know about, you know, this whole group of queer women that lived in Paris in sort of the 1920s that basically invented modern art. And, you know, people that were in the social rights movement and the queer women of color who were really at the forefront of the civil rights movement as well. I didn't know about any of that. So we do have to be willing to educate ourselves, even if we think we are a really good ally. Like maybe we don't know everything.
Yeah, yeah, we're always learning. And I think that is something that is quite nice about social media or Instagram anyway, that you can find a lot of like infographics and learn a lot from that, making sure that your feed is diverse and that you're following a variety of different people so you get all those different perspectives is really important.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's actually a really good way. And that's actually something I've tried to consciously do in lockdown as well, is like unfollow lots of girls in bikinis that make me feel insecure about myself and anything, and you know, follow more queer people of color and listen to what they're saying online as well, and like really expand your mind and constantly be willing to learn.
Yeah, I think that's a really easy indicator to, you know, just look at your Instagram feed. Like, are you seeing people of different colors? Are you seeing people of queer people? Are you seeing people of different disciplines? And that's the best way to make sure that you're learning from all of the sources.
Yeah.
And do you think things have changed quite a lot from, like, say, 10 years ago when you first moved to London?
Oh my God, completely changed. I mean, it's completely changed. If there just wasn't the weight behind drag that there is now. I think now, because of the cultural explosion of drag, there is more at stakes and there's more people wanting to do it and coming out with the intention to be a drag queen, which there definitely was not back in the day. There was not like 18-year-olds being like, I'm going to do drag as a profession. Like, that just didn't exist. And if it did, it was very, very rare. And so it does mean that there's more pressure on us, people that have been around much longer. I feel a huge amount of pressure to represent an entire community all the time. Like, really, especially because I am someone that gets put on these like big sort of more mainstream platforms. I feel like a huge amount of pressure to be the best possible version of myself and my community to represent to the mainstream, because that mainstream audience just wasn't listening before and now it is. So the weight behind it is, I feel like drag has definitely got more political as well. There's way more politics. And do you know what? Sadly, it's probably down to the fact that there's more money in it now. Mm. Like, it's become much more capitalistic because there is a monopoly on drag. And I think we all see that and we feel it. And if you're not making money or you're not being successful, then you feel like a failure because so many, I mean, obviously the Drag Race girls becoming so successful financially as well. So you compare yourself to that. And sometimes that can do more hindrance to you than it does good.
Do you feel like there's an oversaturation now? Because even when you think about how many seasons of Drag Race there have been, like how many queens there have been, and how many there are, it's just so many. It's like hundreds that have been on the show.
I mean, yeah, I would not want to be one of those hundreds of girls that have been on the show, for sure. I do think, like, it can be not saturated. If the way it would be not saturated is if drag queens had more opportunities to become successful, if it wasn't that the only way to become mainstream successful was through Drag Race, you know, if we were invited onto comedy panels and onto, you know, other mainstream shows and we were given more opportunity outside of Drag Race, then there wouldn't be an oversaturation. But the point is that it's kind of like this pyramid scheme at the moment. And yeah, Everyone is like going towards that one thing because that is the only way we've currently been told that you can be successful at drag, because that is how drag is being measured now. But mm-hmm. I feel like if the mainstream and producers and people were giving queer people more opportunity to tell their stories, then it wouldn't feel oversaturated. If, you know, we had more queer spaces to perform in, it wouldn't feel oversaturated.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't, you know, being in a competition, I feel like would be the most stressful thing ever. Like, I don't know how to do it, to be honest.
No, I think it's horrible. And like, what it can do to your mental health is like really scary.
Yeah.
Comparing yourself to the Drag Race girls is bad enough. Like, I couldn't imagine. I know how stressful it is being in front of a TV camera. So doing it in that situation, like, I can imagine, is horrible.
Yeah, it's very intense. And I think it kind of creates this like kind of convoluted version of some of the people on there, which is not necessarily who they are. Oh, outside of that, you know?
Yeah. And I think maybe the people watching don't realize that. Like, they don't realize that it's a produced version of the person that they're seeing on the TV. It's not the real them, unfortunately.
Yeah. Especially if you get like the villain edit and you're made to look a certain way. I can't imagine what that must be like.
I feel like you get a lot of anxiety being on that show.
Yeah. How did you find it when you were shooting for Drag SOS? What was that experience like?
It was a delight. I had a lovely time. I enjoyed every single day. it was stressful. It was a very raw experience, I think, because the show we had quite a lot of say in what happened, but also we were being followed around by cameras like all day, every day from like 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. And so, you know, getting in drag at 5 a.m. every day and then being mic'd up and then having a crew of people follow you around a small town is quite scary in itself, because for a lot of us as well, we've come from these small towns that we were going to, like on the show, we go to, you know, really like more isolated places than the cities we live in now. And as a queer person, sometimes going into those smaller towns can be scary because we quite often have trauma attached to these kind of situations. Like I know for myself, like I've experienced homophobia and physical abuse in my hometown, which is a small town. So then being in full drag with like a crew of people, so everybody's looking at you when you walk down the street, is like really scary. And again, making sure that I represent, I put a huge amount of pressure on myself to represent an entire community. And I was very aware that like I was doing this for my community. And so, yeah, I mean, I put a lot of personal pressure on myself. But in terms of like having fun, I had so much fun. I had the most fun ever, like hanging around with Lil all day, every day. She's absolutely hilarious. She talks absolute shit constantly and it's great.
Yeah, it looked like you had a really fun time. And I can imagine the amount of production that goes into something like that. So the long hours and being in drag for that long, that, you know, that's a lot of makeup and costume
It's really hard. It's so hard. Like, I don't think people get how like uncomfortable it is as well all the time. And it's so tiring when you're in it for such a long time. And literally, there were days when like, when we had like our 1 hour lunch break, I would just have a nap on a table in full drag, like not moving. Like, I'm so tired, but I can't get out of drag. And the emotional like trauma of it all, because we were really meeting people that like really were in quite vulnerable situations, some of them, and had things happen or were going through experiences. And we were there to sort of help them help themselves through drag. And you know, I'm an empath and I really do take on people's emotions. So, you know, when a woman is stood in front of me and she's looking in the mirror and she's telling me she hates her body and she hates the way she looks, and you know, this is what I've gone through, like I take that on and I want to make that person feel better. So, you know, we really did put our hearts into it. And it was heavy. It was definitely heavier than we thought it was going to be. We definitely thought we'd be like swanning around, dressing people up, having fun. It's all going to be fun and games. But when you're dealing with real people who have never been in drag before and have never been so vulnerable, it is heavy as well. But I mean, we tried to make it as fun as we could. We did have a lot of laughs as well.
Yeah, I guess you're in a position there where you have to kind of be like almost a therapist, because you've got to listen and you've got to take their stories on, but also keep a cool head and be the supportive person. And I can imagine that would have been like quite a mental strain.
Yeah, and we forget the power of drag because we do it so often. We forget how it felt the first time. You know, the first time that you look in the mirror and you've transformed yourself and you're like, wow, I feel amazing, or I feel like this is who I am. Like, we really forget that very, very quickly when you're going in drag and like running from gig to gig, three gigs a night. Like, you forget how emotional and therapeutic it can be. And so when we were putting these people into drag, like especially a lot of the like cis men, putting them into the drag for the first time and they've never seen themselves like this, or they don't know what to do with this emotion that they're having, it was like we had to really guide them through that. And it was also like very reflective for us to be like, oh yeah, like it's actually really cool drag, isn't it? Like, I've forgotten.
Yeah, I guess because you're doing that switch all the time, so it becomes a bit more normalized to you to like go from like normal person into your drag persona. And then yeah, seeing someone do it and it's like a big momentous moment for them. Most of those episodes, I fully cried my eyes out at the end, because I was like, oh, it's just so beautiful.
I think I cried more than anyone on that set. Like, literally, I don't know if it was like from tired. I think some of it was tiredness, but I did cry like every single time because you could see it in their faces and like the liberation that it gave people and the freedom that it gave people. Like, it was really empowering to see that.
Yeah, I think it's a really healthy thing to have in your life as well, that kind of outlet as a performer to kind of be your aspirational self, basically. And most people don't have that in their lives. So yeah, to give that to somebody is quite precious and special.
And we do forget, I think also because we're surrounded by other artists and other creatives and performers, we forget that so many people do not feel liberated in their own bodies. They don't, I mean, especially like cisgendered women, like a lot of women are in the world and they're scared to even like raise their hands because they feel so self-conscious. Like something as simple as like when you're in a club and you're like throwing your arms in the air, a lot of women feel so insecure in themselves and so unable to take up that space that they wouldn't even do a simple movement like that, never mind, you know, shake their titties and shake their ass in a leotard. And so it does make you want to share that with people because it's so powerful to see people liberated like that, and it can really change people's lives.
Yeah, and I think living in a city and then visiting these kind of small towns, you're actually like, oh, there's so much of the country that is just not as liberal, it's not as free. Like, did you find quite a big shift when you moved to London from where you lived before?
I was ready to like live my best life. I didn't grow up in the Lake District. I did move around quite a lot. And during like my young childhood, my mum was working as a stripper and working in the adult entertainment industry. So I had really grown up around women like that and I'd always seen it, but I did know that it was frowned upon. I did get that vibe from people. Like, I saw the way that people did look at my mum and treat her within society and how I was kind of encouraged to keep it on the down low. You know, like we did have a pole in our front room, but like, and your friends can come and play on it, but like your friends' parents do not come in the house.
And yeah, yeah.
I did see the transformation. Like, she is like a hippie mum through the day who's like wild and free. And then she would like put on her lipstick and, you know, put on her fur coat and then go out on the weekend. And so I did understand that like femininity was something that was performed and that it was played. And I was very lucky that I got to see that growing up. And also because I moved around a lot, I knew there was a world bigger than the small town that I was in towards my old, like later adolescence. So by the time I was like, got to 18, I'd like saved my first month's rent. I was getting on that bus, like nothing can hold me back. Get me to a city where I can be around fun people.
I love that your mum was a stripper. That's so cool. I mean, you had a pole growing up. That's amazing.
My mum is so fit. It's disgusting. We have like the most opposite body types, like completely opposite. She still like now is like so slim and toned and agile. And I'm just like curvaceous and fluffy. But my mum was a really amazing, amazing woman. I think, you know, like a lot of working class women, she still carries a lot of shame in like what she has done for a living, which is so sad. And I do think like she's starting to learn that there is empowerment in it. But I think because society was quite often quite cruel to her as a single mother and in a working class environment, she does still like carry a level of shame around it. I don't know if she's like found the power in it yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think from speaking to strippers who are from like the older generations, like who were like strippers in the 90s and in the 80s and stuff, there was a lot more shame and stigma then. Yeah. And a lot of them still carry that now. Was when I talk to strippers who are like strippers now or like in the last 10 years, there's definitely a massive shift. They're a lot more proud, a lot more open about it.
It was not cool when my mum was, when I was growing up. It was not cool to be.
Yeah. I'm gonna jump back to you performing. What are some of your favorite venues or places that you've performed at?
Oh my gosh, I can't even remember what I've done now. We've been in lockdown for so long. It's like, stage? What's a stage?
Feels like another lifetime, doesn't it?
It does. Like, oh. You know what? I love the places that feel like home. Like, I love the Bethnal Green Workwomen's Club.
Yes.
Like, love it because it just feels like home. You're like,
it's this so is, iconic. Queer, yeah.
It's comfortable. It feels safe. I love the Bethnal Green Workwomen's Club. I still love the Royal Vauxhall Tavern. I mean, I've been lucky. I've performed on like really big stages, but literally whenever anyone asks me, I'm like, oh yeah, that little like dingy hole in East London. I love that. It's generally the most fun. Like if I'm performing on like a huge stage, I get such bad anxiety beforehand. I kind of enjoy it, but I also just am like relieved it's over.
yeah. So yeah, sometimes with performing, I like to see the pictures and videos because then I can relive it without the anxiety. Yeah. But when I'm actually in it, it just feels like a lot is going on and you don't always fully let go and enjoy it. But when you watch the pictures and videos, you're like, oh yeah, that was good.
Oh yeah, it was fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I love Bethnal Green Working Men's Club with the big heart. It's just like an iconic queer venue that has just had so many fun nights at. Like, yeah, I totally... Totally
just,
agree
like,
with that.
Nice room. It's got a really nice vibe. Everyone's really friendly.
Yeah, it's a good size. Like, it's not too big. It's kind of got a slightly cozy vibe, but a lot of people can get in there still.
A lot, yeah.
Yeah. yeah, I just think it's great.
I mean, I love working with Sync the Pink as well. And I love being in Ibiza. I think I'm really lucky that with Glitterbox, I get to go to Ibiza like every weekend in the summer. And you know what? When it's happening, I complain all the time about it. I'm always like, I'm so tired. I can't believe I'm getting on a flight again. Like, my life is so hard. And like, literally, I look back now and I'm like, oh yeah, it's actually really fun, isn't it?
I think that's always the way though. When you're in it, it just feels like a lot. It's only when in retrospect you look back, you're like, oh yeah, that was bloody good.
That is something I really miss. I love like traveling Europe, especially now that I'm like not doing it. I'm like, oh yeah, it's really fun. At the time, you're just so tired, especially if you're doing like a Friday night in London till like 3 a.m. and then I get on a flight and then I get to Ibiza and then I work from like 11 p.m. till 7 a.m. and then I get on a flight and I come back to London and it's like, at the time you're like, ah, but then you look back and you're like, oh, that is like the best time ever, isn't it?
yeah. It is quite intense. Like traveling in itself is exhausting. It's like the least fun thing is carrying the big suitcase around with all the costumes, all the makeup. If we could just teleport from place to place, that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, in lockdown, I got to perform in the Royal Albert Hall. That was like quite iconic.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. That's huge.
Place. And you know what? That's again one of those things that at the time I was like, this is so stressful. And then I look at the videos and I'm like, oh my God, I had so much fun. Like strutting down a runway in the middle of the Royal Albert Hall, just like having all the lights on you, being like, yes, I'm living, like that. Yeah, every stage. I love it's hard when you've been in lockdown for so long, but actually like there are so many amazing places I've performed. I love performing at Printworks as well. I love like big warehousey clubs. I love it when it feels like ram-packed and everyone's sweaty and you can hardly move. Like, I love that. So like wherever that is, I'll take it.
I know it's going to be super weird to go back to that and be like all like crammed in together and being all sweaty. It's going to be like, oh my God, we're doing it, we're living life.
I know. Do you think we're going to have like an anxiety room in every club where like you can go and like have a space and just like be alone for a second? I think it's a really good idea.
I think we do. We're not going to be used to that much energy, especially what you were saying before about being an empath, because I think I'm an empath as well, and sometimes it can be really good because then you get like the high energy and you like absorb it all, but also when things are shit you're really sensitive to it as well.
Yeah, so we'll see. I think we're gonna have to look out for each other when clubs open again and like
ease into it slowly.
Make sure that your friends drink water, and if you need to go outside for some air, get some air.
yeah, there's going to be a lot of people overdoing it, I think, getting overly excited. I would love to take us into the Love, Learn and Dream section, which is just three questions that I ask all of my guests. Mm-hmm. What do you love most about drag?
I love the most about drag the way that it connects people. I think drag is a really good way of opening yourself up to the world and allowing people to come and talk to you. And whether that's when you're walking through a club or whether you're backstage in a dressing room with other performers, I think drag is a really good conversation starter, and it opens you up to people and experiences. And that's what I love the most about it.
And what is the biggest lesson you've learned along your journey?
Oh, my biggest lesson. I mean, there's been so many. That being yourself is actually what will get you the furthest. I think quite often we feel like we have to act like a certain version of ourselves. And especially in drag now, people think that they have to act like a drag queen. But I think what has done me well is being authentically myself. And I feel like so much of society told me for a long time that that was too much, like being myself was a bit too much and you needed to just tone it down a bit. But actually that has been the key to success.
Yeah, just gotta do you, be authentic. It's not really gonna get you very far when you're trying to be someone else.
Yeah, I think people are really drawn to authenticity and you can't buy it.
Yeah, no, so true. The last question, in a world where you had unlimited budget, unlimited access to any venue or place, and no health or safety restrictions, what would you do in your dream routine?
Oh my God, I have loads of Broadway versions of my shows, actually.
Yes!
Do you know what? Whenever you're coming up with a new act, it's good to like think of the Broadway version first and then scale down.
I love that.
Your imagination go wild and be like, I'm going to invent this prop and it's going to be amazing. I would love to have like, well, do you know what? I just watched, this is like not even that cool. I just watched Pink's documentary on Amazon and she had this thing in Wembley Arena, which was like a thing around her waist, which basically meant she could like fly around the entire arena. And after I saw that, I was like, oh my God, I want to do that. That's so cool. I want to be a flying drag queen. Why are there no flying drag queens? Either that or I'd love like a dragon, like a rabbit vibrator bucking bronco for an act that like ejaculates.
Oh my God.
Yeah, like something like that I would love. I love a prop.
That
like
would be magic.
I'm trying to like scale back my props at the moment because it's just not sustainable. But it's so hard. It's such a hard question. Maybe if I had unlimited budget, I'd do like I would do Lady Marmalade, like from the Moulin Rouge version, but it's me, Dolly Parton, Cher and Madonna.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Oh my goodness, that would be everything. What giant props do you already have?
Oh my God, my Barbie girl act, it's got like three dildos in it. One of them's ejaculating and it's got like this present and it's got an inflatable phone and there's like reveals. And then one of my other acts that I do all the time, like the costume has got like five reveals and it's got like a sign and there's just like a lot of shit to cast around. Why can't I just stand there and sing or like just like not have to do an act where I have to think so much and like prepare myself for it? I feel like I'm sometimes I just take on too much. I should stop thinking of the Broadway version. Maybe that was terrible advice.
I mean, we all love a good big prop.
Yeah, I need to do less props because I'm sick of carting around suitcases everywhere.
Yes, yep. Carting around all of the things is not the one. Yeah. The shoes take up most of the room. Well, they do in my case.
Yeah, they do in your case. And do you have to cart around a pole sometimes as well?
Yes, exactly. Oh, that's why I'm always like, I should do something simpler where I don't have to take this massive bit of equipment.
And like if I'm doing like Glitterbox or like a club night where I have to be go-going all night, I'll literally take like 10 outfits. Because like I love the bit in between sets where you can just like put on looks and be like, do I want to wear this or do I want to wear this? And so I end up taking like the most amount of shit and I'll wear like three things. But if I don't have it, then I'll be like, oh, I wish I brought that. And it's not a good habit.
I know, it's just the freedom of having the option to, even if you mostly choose not to use any of the outfits.
Like, something's okay every time that I've never worn. And I'm just like, but maybe this time I'll need it.
This could be the time. Oh, amazing. Thank you so much for today. Where can we find you online?
You can find me on Instagram at @TT_bang and on all other social medias, or just Google my name. I'm everywhere and nowhere at the same time.
I will put all your links in the show notes below. So go follow TT on all of the places. Yay. And thank you everyone for listening today, for tuning in for another episode. We will see you in the next one. Bye everybody.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us today at the Pussy Parlor. If you're left wanting more, we have extra pussy episodes on Patreon, where you get extended interviews with bonus questions. Just search for Kitty Velour Patreon. Make sure to follow us on Instagram at the Pussy Parlor. That's pussy with an X, PXSSY, because we're not allowed the word pussy on Instagram. The tragedy. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. It really helps support the pod. I'll be back next week with a brand new guest. Stay filthy and stay fabulous. See you soon.